You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear about staffing shortfalls and other problems at veterans facilities here in the state. First, Governor Walker declared a state of emergency last week in Kenosha, Racine, and Walworth counties. That came after torrential rains hit southeast Wisconsin and caused widespread flooding. The waters are starting to recede, but for people affected by the flooding, there's still plenty to do. The state's Department of Health Services released guidelines today for people dealing with damage, saying there are still hazards to watch out for during cleanup. Jeff Phillips joins me now. He's director of the Bureau of Environmental and Occupational Health at Wisconsin's Department of Health Services. Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having us on this afternoon.
Well, when we think about flood, of course, we think about the immediate damage and immediate risks, and we talked about that some last week, but that doesn't mean the problems are over. What are the kind of risks that remain after the waters start to go away?
Well, you know, as the water starts receding, a lot of the damage that's caused when people's basements flood or when their homes get flooded the first level, we start thinking about things like mold beginning to form. We want to make sure that as people are trying to reenter their homes, they're having their electronic stove and refrigerator and those types of appliances checked. We want to make sure that their furnaces and their air conditioning units, all those types of things that could potentially cause safety hazards, we want to make sure that they've been looked at, inspected. Hopefully, we've got some electrical inspectors in the area that can think about making sure that the electrical supply systems into those homes are being taken care of as well. And then lastly, we're thinking about the food and the types of supplies that may be within that home. Certainly, we want to make sure that people are thinking about food safety and getting rid of things that look like they've been damaged or contaminated, or places where we've lost power, making sure that anything that would be required to be refrigerated is just discarded to keep people safe from the food safety end of things.
Let's dig into those a little deeper now. Let's start with that mold issue. Obviously, a huge problem after something like Hurricane Katrina, but even smaller flooding incidents like this can be a problem. As the water starts to go away, what can people do in their homes or their businesses?
Well, the first thing is if the basement has been flooded and if you've got block walls or you've got solid walls, our first step would be to do a cleanup, a cleaning with a bleach solution and water. Good scrubbing probably will take care of the potential for mold growth after the water has been gone and cleaned up. If you've got furniture or drywall or paneling or things like that in the basement, quite often we would just suggest that all be removed, because as you get moisture behind the drywall or as you get moisture behind the paneling in that basement, or as all those furniture pieces get wet, you're not going to be able to dry them adequately, and you're going to end up with mold growth in a relatively short time. Certainly, we're thinking of reminding people to remove that, get rid of it, kind of start from scratch. If people need professional services, certainly there are private businesses out there that do mold cleanup and renovation and restoration, and we would just suggest that people contact their local health department or look through their Better Business Bureau to get connected with those types of businesses if that's the direction they wish to go.
I've seen some communities after flooding will have extra garbage pickup to get rid of those soaked pieces of furniture or paneling and things like that. I think that's going on in Burlington, but is that something people should check out post-flood?
That's exactly right. We would suggest that people certainly contact their local public health agencies. In that area, the Western Racine County Health Department, Walworth County Health Department, and Kenosha County Health Departments all have information up on their websites, but certainly people could get a hold of them and find out what's going on to get that kind of stuff removed, those heavy rubbish items.
And Jeff, in a couple months from now, say, what kind of signs should we watch out for that, hey, we might have mold that we didn't catch right off the bat?
I think the biggest thing is certainly if you can see mold, you've got a moisture problem, right? So anything that would have been damaged and you can see that that's mold contaminated, remove it. In those areas where it might be hidden, or you might have seepage or something like that people weren't aware of, a lot of times it just becomes the odor, right? You can smell that moldy, musty issue, and at that point we would suggest looking to see where that moisture is coming from. If it's a substrate, if it's the back of drywall, if, you know, those types of things, it doesn't take much moisture to actually allow mold growth. We've seen situations in past flooding events where a little bit of moisture on that cardboard on the back side of drywall is enough to let mold grow through the drywall and onto the interior side of it.
Talking to Jeff Phillips from the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, looking at things to watch out for after a flood goes away. Of course, we saw that flooding in Burlington and elsewhere last week in Wisconsin, still cleaning up there. Jeff, how about people with well water? Are there things, does a flood present a hazard to them?
It certainly does. If people are on a private water supply, a private well, and they know that that well has gone underwater or has been, you know, has had at least surface water up near to the top of that well, our first thought would be go ahead and have that well disinfected. If people wish to do that disinfection procedure on their own, they can look at the Department of Natural Resources website at dnr.wi.gov. If they look under, you know, if they search for flood, the DNR has a really nice step-by-step procedure for disinfection of that well. We would suggest that if you know that the well has been contaminated, disinfect it first, follow the process, and then sample after the disinfection is completed. That way, you know, we will be getting basically a clean water supply, hopefully, and people will know that their supply is been taken care of. If people are not sure whether or not that well went underwater or whether or not they've been impacted with surface water, most of those local health departments that I said before will have sample kits available. People can do a bacteria test and make sure that if their water is contaminated, we know that to go ahead and do the disinfection procedure. If it comes back safe, we know that they're in good condition at that point. People also have the opportunity, if they're not sure and waiting for the sample results, they should be finding bottled water or something that they know is coming from a safe supply until they can confirm that well is safe or not.
That release we mentioned from the Department of Health Services mentioned, hey, it's not just the physical stuff, not just the food contamination you mentioned earlier. Mental health and well-being can be an issue for people who have lived through this kind of natural disaster. What kind of advice do you have for people?
You know, again, I think touching base with the local health department and finding the resources in those areas to handle that stress and that mental health perspective would be very appropriate. You know, there are providers out there, but I think, you know, knowing who's in the immediate area, I would say people touching with their local health departments would be able to get some pretty good advice as to where we can get some mental health counseling.
Off the top of my head, I can think of flooding in the last bunch of years in northern Wisconsin, Gays Mills in western Wisconsin, mm-hmm. Now southeastern Wisconsin. We all could see this in our area. What are some preventative measures we can take to protect ourselves from that hypothetical future flood?
You know, I think the biggest thing is really thinking about, you know, being knowledgeable about your environmental surroundings, where you live, knowing that if you're in an area that tends to be flooded, having a plan in place where you know where you're going to go or know who you're going to contact, working very closely with your local environmental health department as well as your local emergency managers so that, you know, you can be familiar with how that community handles a flood event, where they're going to send people for sheltering, or where you're going to find the resources to help clean up. I think it's one of those things to know your community and to know who's doing what within that community.
We'll leave it there for now. Jeff, thanks a lot for taking the time.
All right. Thanks for having us, and we appreciate working with Public Radio.
That's Jeff Phillips, Director of the Bureau of Environmental and Occupational Health at Wisconsin's Department of Health Services. He joined us to talk about what to do after floodwaters recede after those torrential rains hit several Wisconsin counties last week. If you're one of our listeners in Burlington, good luck to you. I hope everything's cleaning up okay. The West Wisconsin Veterans Home at King is facing a staffing crisis, according to the union that represents workers, like nurses. They say the staff are working longer hours and that being short-staffed leaves those on the clock in potential danger. This is the latest in a series of ongoing issues facing veterans hospitals in Wisconsin. And in news out this weekend, some programs aimed at helping homeless veterans in the state are losing federal funding. Caitlin Farrell joins us now. She's a public affairs and investigative reporter for the Capital Times. Caitlin, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into the story about staffing levels, I want to get into news that came out this weekend. Funding for some long-running programs, mainly targeting homeless veterans, apparently are getting cut. Tell us about the programs that are affected.
Sure. So the state runs with some federal funding. They run three separate programs. They're residential housing programs, primarily targeted for homeless veterans at their veterans nursing homes. So they have one at King, Union Grove, and Chippewa Falls. And so the one at King was one of the first ones in the country. And so, yeah, they just got word last week that the federal funding that they had been getting for several decades to run those programs, they're no longer going to get. So they have to close them.
And as I understand it, there was a change not that long ago where it used to be the funding, once they got it, just kind of kept going. They had to start reapplying for it. Is that right?
Correct. Right. That's what Secretary Dan Zimmerman told me. So the program at King had been running since 1994, and they had gotten a federal grant to run that program. So it's like the federal government gave the state money, and then the state turned around and hired a contractor to run those programs and sort of funneled the money that way. So, yeah, they were able to sustain it for several years that way, and I guess there was just a change in funding over, you know, a couple of years ago where they got a one-time grant and then the opportunity to extend that, and so they applied again now to get their grant with the potential for extensions, and this time it was not renewed. So
between those two homes that are not going to get funded, how many veterans, previously homeless veterans, were using this program?
So, 47 veterans are going to have to be moved to other facilities. That is slightly less than the number of beds available. I believe 60 beds there was available at King and at Union Grove. So they didn't quite have all the beds filled at this point. But the Chippewa Falls program, which is the newest one, did get conditional funding, but that's not finalized yet. So I guess they got a signal from the federal VA that they think that they're going to get funding, but they have to wait a few more weeks to see if that actually comes through. And my understanding is if they don't get federal funding for that one, that it would have to close as well because the state just can't make up the difference.
I know this is new news, but is there a thought as to what's going to happen to those 40-plus veterans who are affected here?
So Secretary Zimmerman told me last week that he is monitoring the situation and is going to work to make sure that those other veterans are placed in other comparable programs. And so I'm not quite sure on the details exactly, but I think that the agency is going to be looking into, programs sort of around in the same location where they had theirs to try to see if there's other beds available to transfer them to.
And I read in your piece, it looks like we don't really know why the funding wasn't renewed. Is that right?
Right. WDVA said that they don't really know. Apparently, you know, they file for an extension. That application is reviewed, by different reviewers at the federal VA, and they haven't really been able to get an answer as to, you know, why exactly this time it was not renewed. WDVA did tell me that their sense is that the federal VA is moving more towards favoring nonprofits managing these types of programs rather than states doing it. And so that was sort of a conjecture that the secretary had, that maybe they really want the states to kind of get out of the business of these homeless residential programs.
We're talking to Caitlin Farrell now, reporter, looking at some news about veterans' homes here in Wisconsin. And I wanted to turn to the King Veterans Home in particular. This has been a lot of stories coming out about King on and off over the last year or so. Now, a key public employee union, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME, has been critical of the staffing levels at King, and they used the event of a storm to really try to make their case. Can you tell us that story?
Right. So, AFSCME published a post on their blog last week highlighting what they told me was a composite of experiences from a variety of workers at King, and talked about how how workers had to deal with a huge storm that hit the area back in June, where power was lost to businesses throughout the area, but also King. So the post was written, the Wisconsin AFSCME chapter has a new communications director, Michael Horecki. He wrote that post. He's quoted in my story. Just really highlighted some specifics about what happened that day, but what Michael told me, too, he really sort of wanted to re-highlight and surface for folks is just this ongoing staffing shortage that you know, King is struggling with and has been struggling with for several years when it comes to direct care for the veterans there.
What do we know about the scope of the staffing shortage? What kind of things are we seeing at King?
So we're seeing forced overtime, which the agency says is a condition of employment. So, you know, when CNAs or nurses sign on and agree to be employed there, they know that that's a possibility. But that's something that the union has highlighted and I've written about, too. This can be a real concern when, you know, you have some really sick veterans that require an acute level of care and, you know, there's people caring for them who are on forced overtime and have been working consistently. So there's been that. There's also still unfilled shifts that do persist there. And so the state does contract with a temporary staffing agency. So that staffing agency will supply them with CNAs as needed. The union contends that, you know, the state shouldn't be hiring those folks. Instead, they should be focusing on trying to increase wages or do things to retain and care for the state employees. Those temporary workers get a higher wage in lieu of benefits that like state workers would get. And then there's also about 100 unfilled certified nursing assistant positions that still are unfilled. And that number has pretty much stayed the same over the last few years. And there is a shortage in the industry at large. And the agency also contends that, you know, King is in Waupaca County, a pretty rural county. There's at least 8 other nursing homes in that county, and it can be difficult just to get people to find, you know, to tap the workforce to fill those positions. But a combination of those three things just continues to make staffing, you know, a challenge and a point of criticism for workers' advocates.
In your reporting on this, you talked to people from the union and from the State Department, and it sounds like everybody agrees there is a shortage. There is dispute, apparently, over how much, you know, forced overtime particular workers are having to do. There's a dispute over the extent of this shortage.
Right. Yeah. Yep. That's about right. I mean, I think everyone agrees that there's a shortage, and I think everyone agrees, too, that and acknowledges that the nurses, CNAs there really are doing the very best they can and have, you know, the best of intentions when it comes to really wanting to provide great care for the veterans who live at King. But I think, yes, like you said, there's a dispute there. I mean, the agency says that it's under control. Secretary Zimmerman has come in, and he says that he's worked on a variety of personnel initiatives to retain and hire CNAs, and that he's really done some, he's put in place some measures to kind of make the schedule work out better. So it's not as kind of draconian as the union would portray it, according to the agency. So, you know, WDVA says that folks have a choice. You know, they can sign up for overtime hours. They can kind of try to fit that into their schedule. He maintains that, you know, there is a focus on state employees who are well taken care of and that the temporary CNAs that come in are experienced and go through a screening process to make sure we don't just have temps coming in who have no experience and, like, have no familiarity with what they're doing. And so I suppose the disagreement there really comes in with, like, the scope of the problem there. But, yes, I mean, the agency now acknowledges that it is a problem. It's something they're working towards and that things there are going well. They're really happy with the level of care that is provided to residents there, and they maintain that they're doing a really good job.
And you also write that the Veteran Affairs Secretary is looking at reducing the capacity of King Veterans Home. So they can't bring in the staff, apparently, so maybe fewer residents, fewer patients?
Right, yep. And that was something else that came out during my discussion with him last week, is that they officially reduced the bed count. It was 721 beds, and now, I don't want to misspeak, I think it's 660 or so. But right, he said that he had said that there were some beds that just were not filled generally, but that it made sense to reduce the bed count to really better align with the workforce, the realities of the workforce they have. And so, I think that is something that, you know, I had talked about in some earlier reporting I did. They had the home at a much higher capacity than what's standard in the industry, at more like 95% full versus more like 80% or so. And so It has 662 beds, down from 721.
Okay.
So, right, but yes, that was a move also that Secretary acknowledged, right? You know, we have these workforce challenges. There were some beds that were not filled, and so it just makes sense to officially lower that count at this point.
Again, is there a sense that somebody else can pick up the slack if they were at operating close to capacity and they've lowered their capacity? Some of these veterans are going to need to go somewhere else?
Right. Well, I'm not quite sure, I guess, at this point. I think that there are two other veterans nursing homes in the state. And so I think right now the agency, from what I understand from my conversations with Secretary Zimmerman, I think the agency, too, is trying to really do the best it can, it says, to place veterans, you know, in the facility that best fits them. And so, you know, maybe if a veteran wanted to come to King and there's no longer a bed there, they could see the feasibility for putting them at Union Grove or Chippewa Falls or finding a better option there. And so, I think there would be availability for them to increase capacity at another home or move those beds somewhere else at some point. Especially like at King 2, there's going to be another residence hall. It's actually a separately licensed nursing facility that Moses Hall is scheduled to be built or start construction here in the next year. So, you know, there's going to be beds coming online with that facility as well.
Caitlin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Caitlin Farrell is a public affairs and investigative reporter for the Capital Times. She joined us to talk about a union complaint that the Wisconsin Veterans Home at King is chronically understaffed and that the staff is overworked. She also caught us up on changes coming up to some programs that assist homeless veterans in the state. Now, both Democrats and moderate Republicans have raised red flags in the GOP Senate health care bill. One of the biggest areas of concern that critics have raised is how it deals with opioid addiction. The new bill gives $45 billion to fund the fight against the opioid epidemic, but some are questioning how effective that will be with larger rollbacks to Medicaid, especially since many of the people seeking treatment for addiction rely on that health program. The controversy over the federal government's role in fighting the crisis comes as states are taking big steps to fight the opioid epidemic. Today, Governor Walker signed 7 bills to fight opioid addiction. Joining us now to look at what the GOP health care bill could mean for the opioid crisis is Dr. Mike Miller. He is the medical director of the Harrington Recovery Center at Rogers Memorial Hospital in Oconomowoc. Dr. Miller, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, as you're watching, and this is changing from time to time, but big picture, how do you think the GOP health care bill would affect people currently seeking treatment for opioid addiction?
It would be devastating. The situation before the two big pieces of legislation in my field, which were the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act of 2008, signed by George W. Bush, and then the ACA, which is more well known, were that addiction and mental health both were finally treated on an equal basis with medical surgical conditions. And people could seek care using their private insurance, and there wouldn't be insurance barriers. There are all sorts of provisions to these bills, including a prohibition on the number of visits you could get per year, or the number of days in the hospital you could get, or lifetime caps on benefits. And those were eliminated. The ACA affirmed that and expanded it, and more people were eligible because there were some exclusions in the 2008 bill that were reduced in the ACA. And so I spent most of my career in a situation where there were a lot of cases, but not many patients. People had the disease, but they couldn't get care because of financial barriers. And about 80% of the addiction treatment in the United States was offered through public sector mechanisms like Medicaid and just federal block grants. And the private sector, like commercial health insurance plans, just wasn't in the game. What happened with the ACA on top of the parity bill is that in the private world where people have employer-based health insurance, my goodness, they had access to treatment. And the thing that was really important in the ACA, which is absolutely targeted through the Senate version of the bill, is the essential benefits package, which said that emergency services, preventive services, inpatient care, a variety of types of care, certainly reproductive health care, but included were mental health care, addiction care, essential benefit. So you couldn't sell a policy in the individual market without these benefits. And group plans were required to have these benefits. Actually, they weren't required to have them. If you had benefits, they had to be at parity. But the individual market, you had to have the benefits, essential benefits package. So these various versions, the House version, the various and sundry Senate versions, as they're trying to cobble together a majority, all are doing some of the basic things, really taking a huge hit at Medicaid. But on the private side, getting rid of the essential benefits package. And so people will not have access. Certainly the opioid epidemic has a lot of attention these days, and rightly so. Again, it still pales in comparison to alcohol. And people need treatment for a variety of addiction and mental health conditions. And so, really, Rob, we could talk about the policy and the politics. But the politics is trying to get 50 votes. And so your listeners are probably pretty knowledgeable about this stuff, how just like happened with the ACA, where you find one senator you need to give them a plum, they're going through like seven senators to give them all a plum for Louisiana, Alaska, various states where there's a key senator. But I do find it a bit cynical that this idea of if we could just throw $45 billion at the opioid epidemic, maybe we'd get people to sign on for the bill. I can tell you, practicing addiction medicine, $45 billion would be great, but it's a bribe. And it's not going to come close to counteracting the devastation in reducing access to Medicaid and all the Medicaid expansion states and getting rid of the essential benefits package.
Right. So we're not even necessarily just talking about the funding levels, the amount that's cut from Medicaid, the amount that's thrown into targeted opioid funding. This essential benefits issue, what would happen to someone currently in one of these plans who has to sign up for a plan that might not have that addiction coverage?
Well, you know, for not obviously not forever, but since employer-based health insurance, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, and all the commercials, the Aetnas and the Prudentials and the Hartfords and everybody's came into vogue, mental health and addiction were discriminated against. The benefits were very different. They were either non-existent or very limited. Okay. So you could have great insurance. I work for a Fortune 500 company, and I'm insured. But for this area, you were grossly underinsured. And if you could get payment for treatment, pretty soon it would end because it would be capped. That's the way the world was before 2008. It changed with parity. The ACA then, again, expanded all of this. But what would happen is you will be able to purchase insurance that I would call lousy insurance. People use different terms, and people use euphemisms that want to say it and say, well, something more affordable. Well, it's more affordable because it doesn't cover as much. And so if you've got a med-surg problem, well, that's fine. But if you have a mental health or addiction problem that was covered at parity, at par, under the essential benefits of the ACA, no more with this Senate bill. And so you may have the ability to get your surgery covered, even your obstetrical care covered. Forget about it when it comes to these things that would be taken out. If it's not an essential benefit, the insurers don't have to carry it. They'll cover it. So you can build a plan which has less benefits. And that's the thought, is that people will think it'll never happen to me, and so they won't buy it. They won't select it. You know, contrary to the statement that our president made a while back, of course, we all know healthcare is complicated. It's very complicated. And this whole issue of parity and essential benefits, it sounds so wonky and people's eyes glaze over, but real lives are affected by this stuff.
We're talking to Dr. Mike Miller with the Harrington Recovery Center at Rogers Memorial Hospital in Oconomowoc, also past president of the American Society of Addiction Medicine, looking at the Senate health care plan, how it would cover addiction treatment, opioid, but not just opioid addiction treatment. Let's talk a little bit, Dr. Miller, about effective addiction treatment. I think people think of maybe a methadone clinic for opioids, or people think of somebody ending up in the emergency room or getting that Narcan dose after an overdose. I'm seeing more and more people saying, yeah, and it matters having that primary medical contact to work in the depression treatment, maybe to cover all the other things that go into that addiction.
Well, I'm preparing a talk to give next month that says, you know, when you know addiction, you know medicine, because every aspect of the person's life is affected by addiction. You mentioned all sorts of things, including emergency room visits, but also infectious disease. The epidemic of HIV is less than at its peak, but the epidemic of hepatitis C far outpaces the scope of HIV. So from injection drug use, the diseases that are transmitted, certainly treatment-resistant tuberculosis in folks that are really in tough inner-city environments. There's so many things that addiction affects. Perinatal withdrawal syndrome, neonatal withdrawal syndrome when mom has been exposed and the baby is, let's not say the baby's born addicted because they're not. They're born physically dependent and may have to go through withdrawal management in the NICU. But you got so many different aspects of this. And so, you know, what is addiction treatment? Well, first of all, it should be compassionate. It should be evidence-based. And it should be medical care. And having physicians involved, this is what I've spent my career as an addiction medicine physician and leading the American Society of Addiction Medicine to get doctors more involved in this. So it's not something where you go to your doctor and you ask about addiction care and they say, I don't know, I wasn't taught this in medical school. Well, in fact, they weren't. But that's starting to change. So it should be comprehensive. You should be able to screen for depression or other mental health issues when somebody comes in with a substance use disorder. We should be able to use medications. They're FDA-approved medication for addiction. And we should use chronic disease management. We should follow people over time. It's a chronic disease, just like hypertension, diabetes, or depression. You're not going to make it go away with 30 days of anything. This is going to be a condition with the person's life for a long time. And so being able to have a good enough dose and duration of care, keep people involved with a professional over time, monitor them using lab tests. One of the new things from the American Society of Addiction Medicine is a big monograph on urine drug testing and how that can really help the clinical situation, not just using it in employment situations to find people and weed them out. That's not what drug testing should be used for. It should be used to help monitor people's state of abstinence when they're in treatment. So counseling, medication, long-term engagement, respect and compassion, integration with general medical care, integration with mental health care. That's what addiction care is in 2017, if you have access to it with insurance.
Dr. Mike Miller is with us, medical director of the Harrington Recovery Center at Rogers Memorial Hospital in Oconomowoc. We are talking about addiction treatment and the Senate health care bill. He and others are worried about how that legislation could affect addiction treatment in Wisconsin and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, maybe your experiences. Do you or someone you know struggle with opioid addiction? What do you think of the GOP healthcare bill's plan to deal with that crisis? Share what addiction recovery resources have been useful to you, and let us know if you rely on Medicaid. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Dr. Mike Miller is with us, addiction psychiatrist at Rogers Memorial Hospital in Oconomowoc, past president of the American Society of Addiction Medicine, talking about the GOP health care bill and what it can mean for people seeking treatment for opioid addiction and other addictions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this an issue that is important to you that affects maybe you or someone in your family? What are your thoughts on this bill? Have you gotten addiction treatment? Has someone close to you? Should it be covered by insurance, by Medicaid? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Before we go to our callers, Dr. Miller, you're tracking this issue closely. Can you give us some numbers that put this this story in perspective?
I'd be happy to, Rob. Before the ACA was adopted in the Essential Benefits Package, 30% of health plans sold in the individual and small group market did not have addiction benefits at all. There's been a treatment gap that's been followed my entire career. The data goes back way into the 60s on the percentage of people with addiction and those who need treatment and those who actually get it. There have been times where the gap was 95%. Only 5% of people who needed treatment got it. And this the ACA and the parity bill before it had been so important. There was a 20% reduction in the treatment gap just because of this legislation that would all get repealed if the sponsors in the Senate get their way. 50% of the Medicaid spending on treatment for addiction has come from Medicaid expansion. Getting rid of that would devastate those people. 2.8 million Americans with addiction gained coverage for the first time through Medicaid expansion alone, not just what happened in the private market with the essential benefits package. These are real lives. And, you know, the House bill that was so pilloried had $2 billion for opioids. And they're trying to sweeten the deal to get more people to vote for it on the Senate side. Now they just raised it to 45. Oh, my God, what a huge number. But, again, Medicaid is still a big part of the coverage for folks that have this disease. We can't forget what's happening on the private side. And on balance, this bill is supported by, I'm not quite sure who, but we know who opposes it. And the statistics are 80 to 88% of the public, but the American Medical Association, American Psychiatric Association, American Academy of Pediatrics, American Society of Addiction Medicine, American College of Emergency Physicians. I mean, the doctors know what coverage means to people. And adopting this proposal for repeal and replace the way it's structured now would be devastating to people's lives. People would die.
Let's bring on our callers now. Dale joins us in Chippewa Falls. Dale, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. First of all, I agree with your guess that this $45 billion is just a bribe, absolutely, and I don't agree with that. But here's my question: I've been paying my own health insurance for years, and so now I'm on an individual plan. My wife and I are on an individual plan, and we are forced to pay this, you know, super high premium. In fact, by the way, our insurance company, we are in Chippewa County, Health Traditions. I'm going to say it. Just dropped out of the individual market. They didn't say why. We just got a letter. So we got through the end of the year to find another, and we really only have one or two options left. But my question is, I would prefer, if I can reduce my premiums, I don't want to buy opioid or addiction. You know what I mean? I don't need mental health. I'm 60 years old. You know what? I would be willing to take the risk to say, if my premium's $300 less, $500 less, whatever it is a month, because it's ridiculous right now.
Dale, thanks for the call. I want to bring Dr. Miller on. This is not an uncommon argument. People say, why should I pay for whatever coverage that I know I'm not going to need, in this case, addiction or mental health treatment, he says.
Well, of course, you know, big argument also, why should I pay for maternity coverage if I'm out of childbearing age? These arguments are made. And again, the ACA looked at the broad picture, and it has to do with risk sharing. When you don't cover certain things, then the people that have it sort of make the risk pool sicker and make the premiums for them even higher. I just read an email today about the situation in Chippewa County with that particular carrier dropping an individual market. Another carrier is moving in, and it's going to cover the same people with Mayo as the preferred provider in that network. So it would be a different carrier, but Dale's raising an important point. The problem nationwide is individual market has suffered because the insurance companies can't predict the future because all this repeal is hanging over their heads. And so to project into the future, their actuaries are setting up worst-case scenarios. These premiums don't have to be this high if they have a predictable marketplace in which to operate. And what's happened is, without tweaking, repairing, making better the ACA, if your only option is repeal, then it's the current situation is tough, and it is rising premiums for the individual marketplace. But we could fix that, and that's what I think members of Congress want to do if given the chance, is to stabilize individual markets so these premiums won't go up like this.
Dale, thanks for that call. Good luck as you change coverage. Talking to Dr. Mike Miller about addiction treatment and the Senate health care plan. We go next to Kenna in Racine. Kenna, hi.
Hi, Dr. Miller. I really appreciate this conversation because even though it's finally the opioid epidemic is finally being made aware of in the public area. My daughter actually died from an accidental overdose of heroin, and the reason I'm so upset about the possibility of Medicaid being cut is because she was in recovery when she had relapsed, and that's when she died. But she would not have been in recovery for, it was about 3 years, if it hadn't been for Medicaid coverage. People have to go in treatment sometimes 2 and 3 times before they get it. Addiction is so powerful. And she did, and she stuck with it, and she had wonderful Medicaid providers, and they helped me get my daughter back for the 3 years prior to losing her. And I also am concerned when the state turns down the extra federal funds that's being offered for Medicaid, because we need more funding, we need more treatment facilities, and we also need facilities that are parent-friendly.
Kenna, thank you so much. I'm very sorry for your loss. Glad at least you had that extra 2-3 years with your daughter, Dr. Miller.
Well, this is a tale told so often. The problem with opioids is that it's, you know, heroin is deadly, but it's all the adulterants in the heroin. And so it's the synthetics, the fentanyls and the sufentanyls and the carfentanyls, and the people that relapse, they're just sitting ducks. They don't know what's in the product they just bought. It's so sad. But there was a quality of life. There was an enjoyment of relationship for 3 years during that good quality recovery. I've done this my whole professional career, and everybody beats up addiction treatment. Why do you have to go back? Well, how many times do people go back for asthma? How many times do people get hospitalized with ketoacidosis for diabetes? And does the patient get blamed when that happens? How many times do people end up with asthma attacks in the emergency room? Do people say, will you please get out of my emergency room? We've already treated you for asthma 3 times in the last 2 years. Get out of here. But if it's addiction, it's like, what are you doing here? You don't deserve this. This is a relapsing illness. Chronic diseases do that. They wax and wane. And the job is to improve quality of life and extend life as much as you can. And professional help can help. And again, both medication and counseling. It's always sad to hear stories like this, but thanks for the call.
Dr. Miller, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
That's Dr. Mike Miller. He's an addiction psychiatrist and medical director of the Harrington Recovery Center at Rogers Memorial Hospital in Oconomowoc. He joined us to talk about how the Republican Senate health care bill could affect the fight against opioid addiction and other addiction treatment issues.